this evening. So we will go ahead since we do have a quorum. First up, we have the Coalition for Rochester Area Housing. Mr. Borkhardt from Rochester Area Foundation is here to present some information.
Thank you. Okay, if I sit, I'll leave you to do as can.
You're comfortable.
In 10 years, you're the first person who ever asked that question, so I guess you get free reign.
Well, some of you I've been able to talk to about this back in December when we were still in the formation stages. And so, as you're aware, keeping aware of the local media, in late December, we were able to make a public announcement about the existence of the coalition, why the coalition structure, why doing something different like this at this time, and a kickoff gift from Mayo Clinic to get the process started. So with the materials you have in front of you, I just put a few slides on the screen here real quick so we can kind of walk through what the structure is and why. Without getting too bogged down in too much history, as you, many of you will recall, in 1999, Mayo started off Rochester Area Foundation in the affordable housing business with a $4 million grant and the promise to add $3 million if we raised that much more in the community, which happened. And with that money, over the course of the next 12 years, 1,100 housing units were created, both rental and single-family for-sale units. We also created a community land trust of 210 properties, where we put a subsidy into each property and then take an ownership stake in the lot, so that that property will always be a percentage below market rate. So there's a 25% subsidy into that property. No matter what happens to the value of that house and lot, we will always be able to resell it for 25% below market rate. So we invested $8.5 million in those 210 properties. We also made $3 million in gap loans to multifamily developers. And those gap loans were 30 years, no payments, no interest, to buy down the cost of financing so that they could hit the price point for rent that they were aiming for. So when we looked at re-energizing 2 years ago, the fundraising for another round of housing creation with subsidy dollars through philanthropy, I came and talked to many of you and many of the other leaders in the community and determined a couple of things. First of all, that the capacity for giving at the rate that we thought was necessary at that time didn't exist in the community at that time. This was early 2016. Then the other thing we learned was there was some question as to whether or not we had been as effective as we could have been with the dollars the first time around. It really wasn't criticism of the First Homes 1.0, if you will. It was more a lack of understanding about what was accomplished, how it was accomplished, and was it the best use of the dollars? In other words, could we have produced more investment for that money, more housing units? And could we have extricated the subsidy money from those projects sooner and returned it to the marketplace so we could use it today without having to go back to our donors every few years for more millions of dollars? So that was our challenge in the last 2 years. In addition to defining the issue and precisely what client group we're talking about in the community and why it was a problem and what had changed over the last 20 years, to make the affordability gap grow as it has been, or to escalate, was can we come up with a way to return those philanthropic dollars to the marketplace more effectively? And can we create a system of metrics that is constantly feeding back to the donors that their property, that their investment has accomplished what we had hoped to accomplish? Because that was missing the first time around also, which is what led to questions later on. So as we worked with our anchor donor, the Mayo Clinic, over the last couple of years, it was clear that they were going to get involved. It was a matter of how much and when and how we could structure it to accomplish those goals that I just mentioned. At the same time, both you, the city, and the county were interested in participating, but of course you have to be in charge of your money also by statute. So what kind of creature could we create that would accomplish all that that's different than just the housing trust fund where you give the money to an entity like Rochester Foundation and they appoint a committee of some sort to make all the decisions? How could we create a consensus model that left everybody in charge of their own money and returned real-time feedback and metrics as to the performance of the investments. And that's what gave birth to this notion of the coalition. And essentially, do I have it in front of me? The leadership coalition front and center initially is going to be the city by virtue of your governance authority and the resources that you will bring to the table. The county, for the same reason, the resources that bring to the table via HRA and their governance authority. Mayo has made a pledge of $4 million for the first 2 years, and they are going to open a donor-advised fund specifically for housing at Rocheteria Foundation. Why that? We didn't want to create a whole new vehicle. And donor-advised funds are the way we do business already, so it was already a vehicle that had its own process in place to protect how that money is spent. Other employers, major employers, or other entities that want to give up to a minimal threshold could have a seat at that leadership council table. Then I'm going to stop right there at other employers. I'm not going to go down the list any further. So how is the leadership coalition intended to function? It's intended to be a consensus group that spends only its own money. Okay? So now moving to the lower left of the schematic here where it says RAF/First Home Staff. Ideas, programs, project proposals will come in there. So let's say a developer comes to us and says, I want to put up 100 apartments. And I have my financing plan in place, and I need another $100,000 for really low interest to be able to hit the price point, to be able to hit the rents I want to hit. And they would make that presentation. Our staff would vet that presentation. We would call in the resources necessary to analyze it. And then we would send that proposal up to the leadership council and say, just for the sake of this demonstration, this is a good proposal. They need $100,000 and they're going to be able to produce the apartments we want at the price point we need, and they need that money for a 1% interest. So this is something we could do. And so the entities there would look at that project and say, yeah, I think that's a good one. And for example, they might say, yep, we're in for $50,000. And the city might say, yep, we can support this, we're in for $25,000. And the county could say, yep, we can support this. So out of the money they've designated to participate, we're in for $25,000. So we got $100,000. They're only spending their money. Three parties are not ganging up on one party and spending that party's money against their will. They are coordinating their activities so that they're not duplicating or at odds with each other. It's an opportunity for a developer to come one place to be able to seek the financing they need to make it go. So now to carry out the scenario some more, the city representative would then come back to the city council and say, we had this proposal come before the coalition, describe the proposal, say we recommend that we participate in this to the tune of $25,000. The council would have to vote and authorize a distribution from the city to what we're calling on the far right of the slide up there, the Rocheteria Housing Foundation Housing Fund, to make a distribution to that fund. The county would do the same thing. So all of your internal spending protections and processes would apply. The Mayo, for their part, they would simply send a letter to the board of the Rocheteria Foundation authorizing a distribution from their donor advised fund over to the housing fund. From the housing fund, we will write the check to the project. In addition to the check will come a system of metrics and reporting so that the developer has to show on an annual basis, for however many years it's designated for that project, that they have accomplished what they said they were going to accomplish. And as you can see from that arrow that shows the project metric feedback, the information will flow back to the leadership council at all times so everybody's clear that the money accomplished what it was supposed to accomplish. So what about the community engagement aspect? That's on the upper left-hand corner called the Housing Alliance. That's the stakeholder body that serves the coalition. That is the nonprofits and in some cases some for-profits that are in the housing business that understand the business of producing housing. That's also going to be other community groups that have specialized clientele with specialized needs. For example, I've reached out to SEMSO, I've reached out to NAMI, an example of two groups that serve populations that could have special needs housing. It is not the intent of the Alliance to be an advocacy group from the perspective of advocating for specific public policies. It is the intent that they are advocates for their client base, so that the Housing Alliance meetings are not envisioned to be a come-one-come-all community forum. They're envisioned to be purposeful membership of representatives of these entities. Now, some of these entities will do community engagement on a broader scale, and that's the way that information and those concerns will come to the group or come to the coalition and impact deliberations. It is a work in progress. We have tried, as we develop this, to not be too prescriptive. Our crystal ball is only so effective. When we populate these groups and get them together, they will make some decisions as to how they want to govern themselves. I'm hoping to have a first meeting of the Leadership Council by the last week in January so they can make some decisions on self-governance. And the first meeting of the Alliance is already scheduled for, I think, the 15th of February. I can't remember if it's the 15th or the 17th. And those first meetings, since this is a brand new animal, will be spent figuring out how do we want to do this going forward. The general concept is in place, the vision for how it can be a consensus model is in place, but not all the details. If you look to the right, one area, one topic I left out, the kinds of awards that will flow from that fund to the community could be for equity positions in some projects. For example, the Builders Association is in the business right now of designing a sub-$210,000 house. It's going to have to be smaller on a smaller lot. And the question is, will the market accept it? So once they've settled on the design, they're going to need to build X number of models to get them out into the market and see how the public responds to it. It's a proof of concept kind of project. In order to distribute and share that risk, the coalition would decide to take an equity stake in those models, maybe a 50, a 40% stake, that would lessen the burden. So if some money is made, everybody would make a little. If some money is lost, everybody would equally lose some money, so that the developers aren't shouldering that risk all by themselves to incent them to try these products that have not been proven in our market thus far. That's one example. The gap loans to multifamily developers that have been customary as another example. A third example is we know that it is very difficult to subsidize a project sufficiently to build a new project all the way down to a price point of somebody earning half of their median income, or about $34,000, $35,000. It takes a lot of subsidy to get an apartment down to that rate. So what is our stock for those kinds of apartments? Existing apartments. So it's very important that we be able to retain those apartments, both keeping them up to speed so that they're attractive and marketable, and preventing them from being absorbed by investors coming to town looking to push them up into the market rate and therefore losing them to the low and middle income rates that we want. The same thing is taking place in the community right now relative to single family home ownership. There's a lot of investor interest in houses that are coming on the market for under $100,000. And investors are buying them and oftentimes renting them for market rates, so we lose them as a wealth building tool for low and middle income people. So that's another program that would be an example of the kinds of things that the coalition could get involved under the banner of preservation. And there may be new ideas coming forward. I hope there are new ideas coming forward for proposals for funding. I am committed to raising another $2 million in addition to what Mayo has pledged for the next 2 years. That's a big lift. We only set it for 2 years. That's arguably not enough money in the community to meet the challenge, but it's a start. The other thing that's happening statewide, as you most of you are probably aware, is that this issue is becoming more dominant throughout the state. And there are a couple of bills that are coming forward in the legislature this year. As more and more of our state and local governments understand that we have to take a more purposeful and intentional role in creating housing at this price point, we are finding new and different ways of creating revenue and bringing it to the market to help make that happen. And as housing at that level becomes more of an infrastructure item, treated more like infrastructure, we're going to find vehicles available to us that have not been available in the past. That could have an impact on how much philanthropy we need to bring to the table at the local level to make that work. So we set our goal at 2 years, and then we'll see what the future looks like beyond that. The key to the coalition is the money that's been pledged just thus far is just money, and it's short term. But the real big accomplishment here, provided you all participate, is a commitment to participate collaboratively long term. So that unlike First Homes 1.0, that raised a lot of money and spent a lot of money, but when it was gone, there was not the ongoing structure that kept all of the community leaders involved. Going forward, my dream would be that 20 years from now, the city, the county, Mayo, and other major entities in the community are still meeting on a regular basis, keeping their finger on the pulse of the need for workforce-based housing throughout the community. But that's the real accomplishment, if you all agree to participate. And that's what I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to participate both as a entity and by bringing cash to the table. Your cash that you will spend as you see fit, but collaboratively and coordinated with the other leadership group in the Cayman community.
All right. Thank you for a great overview. We had heard a lot of the information as you indicated, and we'll be taking this up formally this evening in the context of our council meeting, so that's when we would actually make any decisions. But for this purpose of this afternoon, questions, comments for Steve? Mr. Wojcik.
So just a few things, and I really appreciate the work you've done on this. You've been a tremendous resource for myself as well, just bouncing ideas off, and you're usually one of the first people that will tell me when I'm nuts, when other people just won't say it, so thank you for the honesty. But you've also helped me create some ideas. A couple of the things that we look back on First Homes 1.0, one of my biggest concerns is, what is our strategy once we create an affordable unit to keep that unit affordable on into the future, as opposed to being a wealth enhancement tool for one particular family or occupant, but not becoming affordable after that. Any thoughts on that?
That was the primary purpose of the Community Land Trust. Mm-hmm. And it's been a good investment, it's been a good program. The weakness, if there is one, of the Community mm-hmm. Land Trust, is that 15 years hence, half of our properties have turned over, but half have not. And of the properties that have not sold, we have no way of knowing if the owner, the original owner, is still income qualified. They had to be income qualified to be able to buy it. It's 15 years later. They may make four times more in the income qualification. And they don't need that subsidy anymore. But we have no way to compel them to relinquish that subsidy so we can extract it from that property and move it forward for anyone to serve a new young family or a new needy family at this point in their life. Now, I'm not saying it's the fault of the program. It's the way the program was designed nationwide. It is evolving as being a limitation that makes current investors wonder if it's the most effective use. One of the things we're doing with the three homes that we are building at the gardens that will be they will be sold for $186,900, we hope, 1,250 square feet slab on grade, two-car attached garage. Is our program is going to sell them only to income qualified buyers. We are going to require that they occupy them, they have to live in them, and that if they decide to sell, they give us first right of refusal so we can buy them back at market rate and make sure they get resold into the market. So it's those kinds of purchase agreement restrictions that we will experiment with. Now, we may find out that we can't sell them under those kinds of restrictions. We don't know. But right now, it's worth a try. So to answer your question, those are the kind of mechanisms we think we need to have going forward to keep those homes available for sale for low and middle income folks.
So another question related to that. I'm glad that this is one of the things that some private parties are pursuing in terms of creating these more affordable homes. I'm always hesitant to say affordable at that price point because I get yelled at a lot if I call a $180,000 home affordable.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that I've always been a little bit skeptical of the single family detached because the underlying property and the infrastructure expenses don't change regardless of the size of the house. I've always been interested in an approach where we look at the creation of condos in Rochester, because I believe that can be done much more cost effectively and efficiently. Do you see a path forward with this and trying to get some condos approved? And secondary question to that is, one of the issues with condos is getting mortgages for condos, but one of the trouble getting income qualified people into homes is also mortgages for those individuals as well. How are we handling the financing of this?
Well, I don't know how we're handling the financing for that just yet. We're going to have to see how that evolves. We know there's been some changes in the legislature that have made condos more attractive, and we're starting to see them proposed again now. Relative to my crystal ball of the future and what housing looks like, I think it's going to look very different 20 years from now than what we're accustomed to right now. There's a lot of there's numerous things that are evolving. Pocket neighborhoods, where it's not just linear blocks, rectangular block after rectangular block with rectangular lots, where there's common space, where the backyards are now. Co-housing, a concept that comes out of Denmark that's moving across the nation, where it's a purposeful and intentional cooperative neighborhood of people helping each other, and the houses arranged in pocket neighborhood arrangements. You know, the sky's the limit. We know that everybody has to have a place to lay down every day. Mm-hmm. And the models that we've employed to date aren't going to take us into the future. Mm-hmm. And there are people out there with a vision and with some risk capacity and a fire in their belly, and they're going to make a difference. I just can't tell you what they all are right now. And I think we need to be receptive to some different land use ideas and to some different models, because the models of the past aren't going to serve us way into the future. But I can't tell you what they all are because I'm old.
So one of one of my concerns, and we'll have an opportunity to discuss this tonight too. I think I don't know if the community network necessarily understands that this is part of Rochester's what we need to do to address affordable housing, but this is not the extent of what we need to do to address affordable housing. This is a small part of it. I'm a little bit afraid that there's going to be a perception that pursuing something like this allows us to shrug off all of our other potential responsibilities in the area. And I'm going to want to be very clear in communicating that this is a part of a project that we're involved on that is part of a much larger affordable housing strategy. And the other thing, you know, I believe the ask tonight is for the $250,000 buy-in at the council. And what I would say is that just based on some of the other discussions that we're having, it's something that we need to carefully consider, and as we do that, I want to make sure that we're simultaneously considering the governance and oversight of how we handle our investment at the same time that we approve the funding, because I don't want to get into a situation where they go down different paths and one can get through and the other one can't. So just as we have that discussion tonight, that's going to be something that's important to me as well.
Steve, I like the concept. I think it's a nice idea, and it's come a long ways from where we started, which was with nothing. And what I do want to ask is, it says Rochester area, and I think we all believe that there needs to be buy-in from communities around Rochester. Is this being made open to them to participate as well?
Yes. What we think of as our catchment area for Rochester Area Foundation is 35-mile radius from Rochester, which gets you out beyond Olmsted County quite a bit. Given that this is a consensus model, if a project came in here for example, Dodge Center, the city may not be able to participate with your money. The county may not be able to participate with their money. It leaves the door open for other members of the council to participate with their money. So, again, consensus model where activities are coordinated, not duplicated, not at cross purposes.
Thank you.
Mr. Hickey?
Hey, thanks a lot for good information, and I appreciate the information we got in December, too. What I had heard up till now was I kind of think of it as PAYGO TIP. We'd be making our commitment out of our set aside from TIP projects, kind of on a project by project basis. But the ask tonight is kind of a $250,000 commitment, and we'll see where goes at the public hearing, but at this point I'm not completely comfortable with that. I mean, I think there's a lot of good ideas here, but it's one of these things I kind of want to see the project get out of the gate and down the road before we make a big upfront commitment. I'm certainly comfortable, on a project-by-project basis, But I'm not, at this point, comfortable with the big upfront commitment.
All right. Anyone else?
You know, maybe one other item, too, is it's good that there's going to be so many different private parties that participate in this. One of the things that, from a governance standpoint, that we want to be careful of is that hopefully, I mean, a positive outcome of this would be if some of the different organizations that do development in the community became a partner on the leadership board through investments of their own. That said, if that's the case, at that point, how do we handle potential conflicts of interest as well? And I think having a policy up front that addresses that would be something that would save us some potential struggling in the long run.
That's part of what we need to discuss as we get it off the ground, and what I did not want to be too prescriptive about on the front end. One thing I will say is, at the inception, the Leadership Council was the four entities I've named. And if somebody else came along, why did we have a $250,000 threshold? To entice some folks to get involved, not to shut anybody out. Mm-hmm. If an entity, any grantor, is going to give you multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, they need to, A, trust your expertise, B, trust your reputation and your credibility, and C, have some ability to direct how that money is spent. Mm-hmm. So that's what's offered as an enticement. If you get involved with us for $250,000 or up, you can decide how your money's being spent. Now that said, earlier I said I wouldn't talk about the bottom three boxes. I will quick now. Grants, donations, and potential revenues from new market tax credits or other government programs could all feed into the Rochester Area Housing Foundation housing fund that's on the right of the screen. In addition, there could be some interest-bearing loans that are made from there. There could be some equity positions that could make some money. That fund could grow. The Leadership Council could find itself making decisions about other people's money. And at that point in time, I would expect the Leadership Council would look for a way to expand its influence. But at the inception, we're starting with the four, anticipating that it will evolve. Again, not being too prescriptive, but knowing this thing is going to take on a life of its own and needs to in order to be responsive to what the needs are 5 and 10 years down the road.
All right. Anything else? Once again, we'll take this topic up this evening, hopefully for some sort of formal action. Thank you, Steve, for a great presentation.
Thanks.
We'll see you later this evening.
You will.
All right. Moving on to our other topic for this afternoon, the 4th Street Southwest Geometric Layout of work staff.
So while Dan Coyle and Kimley Horn is our project engineer manager on this project, we selected Kimley Horn because they're involved in Discovery Square Phase 1. They're involved in Discovery Square Traffic Impact Report. They've been involved in Discovery Walk Concept Plan Development, and their firm is also the lead in the ITS, Integrated Transit Studies, parking study for the DMC plan. So Dan's in the middle of all of this. He's working with our staff a lot on all of these projects. Dan's going to give a brief overview of the geometric layout plan for the project. The timing of this project is being driven by Discovery Square Phase 1. New sewer is needed for that project. Discovery Square Phase 1 is on the south side of 4th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue, and we need to get the sewer in place, and as part of doing that, we have to reconstruct the street. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan. There's no ask today. On the 5th, your meeting on the 5th, we'll actually be formally back asking you to approve the feasibility report, the geometric layout plan, and scheduling a project hearing for the project. So today is informational, but Dan, I'll turn it over to you.
We have a quick question here from Mr. Bilibet.
Before we get started on this, I've got quite a few calls about concerns about the way this project has been run. And it's not the project itself, it's the process. And the fact is that neighborhoods, different stakeholders were told that they would have some response given to them from the companies involved, our contractors. and they'd sent some information to them over a week ago, and they have not gotten any kind of response. Now, even though we're talking about something, this is just an informational bit today, and then preliminary, the problem is what we've seen is we've seen too many times that once we cross this threshold into going in forward, those requests, those thoughts, concerns of the neighborhoods are often left behind. I'm a little concerned about this, that there wasn't better timing. I understand the concern about sewer or the Discovery Square, but I really want to make sure that we understand that when we go out and ask our contractors, when we go out and talk with the groups around the stakeholders, that we make sure that we give a response and that we give an adequate time to have that happen. I will tell you that for the last week and a half, I've been lit up constantly by people's concerns and the fact that they feel, again, that they're being left out, because here we go down this process where we're doing the process where we're not taking in their information. I've had a couple groups come forward who are reluctant to come here, who are very concerned about some of the things that are happening in the planning phase, and they're concerned that they won't have one parking on street by some of the facilities that have employees who use that parking for their people to come to work. So I just wanted to bring to the attention of the council and staff that we need to make sure that we follow through with what we say we're going to do. If we say that we're going to return messages, if we say we're going to return letters or exchange information, if they get it to us, we promise to get it back from them. We either need to have timelines in there for them to understand what that is, or we need to make sure that we give them the opportunity to do so, and we need to make sure that we do that. I'm not trying to go after any one or overall, but we have a sign right behind me and that talks about RISE, which is what we say we're going to do here in the city of Rochester and how we're going to treat our customers. We need to abide by that, and we need to do that. So I understand there are times where timelines get pushed because of different projects and where the projects are, and they may not have conveyed some of that to us, but we need to make every effort that we can to make sure that we do exactly what we promised to do, and we don't make the groups all of a sudden feel like they're being forgotten or they're not being listened to, and it was just kind of a process of that we're going to go through and then we're going to push them aside and walk away. If we're going to say to groups that we want their input, and we're going to give them responses, we need to do that. And that's a little a concern I have about this project is I hear usually from groups, but I have heard from more than typically that I hear from on this concern of the 4th Street reconstruction.
It's unfortunate that you say that because there was a response sent by me personally.
Right, and that was received last night.
Right, but I just finished it. Yes,
yeah.
You know, I worked over it on it all weekend. It was a 3-page response to some bulleted items that we were sent on the 8th. Okay? I think Dan has responded to every single phone call he's received. I know that Dylan and Doug, when they receive phone calls, have responded to every single phone call. I've not received one single phone call myself. So it's unfortunate you're being told that because I don't believe that's the case.
Well, and I just... Again, the reason I bring it up is I think it's important for us to understand, and it's important for us to be probably more clear when we do these things, that when we tell people what a timeline, what a response date is, and what kind of timeline we're looking at. In the world I used to work in, we looked at the date that we needed this to be done in, and we worked backwards so that we had figured out how much time we would need and that available for us to get back to people so there wouldn't be this concern. Again, I don't know who's right and who's wrong. I'm just saying, to me, it's important that we do everything in our power to make sure that if we ask the community input, we get that, give them an opportunity, and we have that opportunity to get that information back and forth.
And we're here today because there was an opening on your calendar. That's why we're here today.
Okay.
Like I say, this isn't scheduled for the council until the 5th. We could have done it on the 22nd, the 29th, or the 5th. We're here today because there was an opening in the college.
And this is for not just this project, this is for all projects that we do and all different activities that we do throughout the city, not just the public works one, but all activities. But I've gotten enough that I said I would make a statement, I would comment on this, and hopefully people are paying attention.
So
Mr. Wojcik?
I just want to add, you covered it very well. I think the Venn diagram of people who call to complain to you is probably overlaps quite a bit with the people who call to complain to me. I heard many of the other comments, but I think the other thing that to say here is there is a lot of mutual respect back and forth both ways between some of these folks who are raising the concerns and Public Works. I mean, there's a lot of things that overlap conceptually in what they're looking to accomplish. And while they sent a formal letter, I think, on January 8th, I think we were both at the open house when they had that. I know I was, you might.
I might not.
I was there, and the comments are very, very reflective of what was said at that open house many months ago as well. And there are just some really good, smart things that they point out in there. We don't need to go through all the details now, but I think there's some more work to be done to figure out how to bring these concepts together, because I think the goals from both sides are not mutually exclusive.
I'll just say that one thing we've noticed too is it is a process, and it things evolve over time. I was noticing in the cover memo that it was noted that several meetings did occur with neighborhood associations, DMC, EDA, and others. But I think one of the things we find is oftentimes, starting with the public input gathering, you get information, plans start to evolve, then they change, and sometimes we don't have this feedback loop that goes back and maybe checks with some of the original participants, and things evolve over time, and you get 2-3 months downstream, and suddenly it looks different than you might have seen in a meeting weeks or months ago. So I think that's just reflective of what happens sometimes with our process. Just a comment. All right, let's let you have at it.
Yes, well, thank you for those comments, and we've had quite a bit of engagement from very smart and passionate people in the area, which is really a testimony to a project that has the kind of input that will make it successful. So we'll talk a bit more about the specific meetings and the process that we've gone through. The agenda I want to go through today will have about 12 slides that talk about the project location, goals, existing conditions, some of our public involvement activities, DMC district design guidelines, how those apply to the evaluation of the designs we've developed so far, and how we work with other studies and projects in the area to coordinate those activities. After about 12 slides, I'd like to roll out the layout, the geometric layout. That's an 8-foot-long drawing. I'd like to put that on the table. We can look at that. I've got that on a PDF. We can also put it up on the screen so everybody can see it, so we can maybe drill down on some specific issues if we have time to do that. So first, project location. I think we're all generally familiar with this, but we're on 4th Street Southwest between 1st Avenue, so Broadway's here, 1st Avenue, and 6th Avenue, just some landmarks along the way. This is Christ United Methodist. This is the Opus building. These are the Mayo Clinic parking lots. So hopefully folks have a sense of where we are in the world. The purpose of the project, the goals of the project primarily are to replace deteriorating concrete pavement, provide some relief for downtown sanitary sewer systems by rerouting, making some connections here that reroute sanitary sewer around the downtown core for future development, and then to provide designs that are consistent with the ongoing DMC integrated transit studies and also the DMC district design guidelines. So just a couple of pictures to get us oriented to the street. So these pictures were taken in a warmer and greener time. So this is a portion of 4th Street that's near the Mayo Clinic parking lots. We've got 4 through lanes, so 2 lanes in each direction. No parking intersection. And sidewalks with a green boulevard. As you go a little farther to the west, 4th Street has parking on both sides of the street, has wider center lanes, about 18-foot wide lanes, but essentially 2 lanes, 1 lane traffic in each direction. So there's a change in the character of the street at about 3rd and 4th Avenue. You lose 2 lanes as you go through the 3rd and 4th Avenue intersections. And that's an important consideration because as we think about how 4th Street can evolve over time, the question came up, do you have to preserve 2 lanes in each direction for traffic? Is the traffic volume high enough that requires those lanes for through traffic, or do those 2 of those lanes serve as turn lanes most of the time? So as we thought about initial concepts that we could begin discussions with stakeholder groups and the public, we came up with the a series of four drawings, so I'll run through those here quickly. The first concept we showed was a roadway that has a 16-foot sidewalk zone and approximately 58-foot curb-to-curb dimension. In this case, would accommodate two through lanes and bike lanes. Using the same general curb-to-curb dimensions, we came up with a second concept that said, well, what if we didn't require two through lanes in each direction? Maybe we could have one lane in one direction and turn one lane into a parking lane, but maybe we still needed two lanes in the other direction, either because of peak traffic issues, or possibly one of these lanes could be a center turning lane, so you'd have one lane each direction and a center turning lane. We looked at another concept that said, well, instead of parking, let's allocate some space to a raised median with generally the same uses around it, a lane in each direction and a center turn lane, or possibly two lanes in the same direction with a bike facility on each side. And then a fourth concept that we had developed was, what if we try to accommodate parking and a raised median and have a turn lane that would remove the raised median in places, but generally a lane of traffic in each direction. So that's where we started. We went to stakeholder groups and talked about those typical sections, and we displayed those typical sections at an open house on October 19th. So prior to the 19th, we met with the DMC EDA to give them a sense of what we were looking at. We talked to the Historic Southwest Neighborhood Association, talked to the Downtown Neighborhood Association, and with Mayo Clinic. And from those initial discussions, it was clear that there was a divergence of opinion about the character of 4th Street. There was both a concern by the neighborhoods that 4th Street wants to be a neighborhood street with pedestrian concerns, parking, traffic calming as a main priority. And talking to Mayo Clinic, there was a concern that with the growth of DMC, the future development that's anticipated, it seems counterintuitive that there could be a recommendation that would eliminate one lane of traffic in each direction so that you could have just one lane of traffic and reallocate right-of-way space to those other uses. So we had those initial meetings, got that initial feedback, had a very productive open house meeting, not just focused on, we were focused on 4th Street, but we also invited the DMC Transportation Studies folks to come to the meeting to talk about the City Loop Trail, for example, and how that project was evolving. And if folks had questions, they could talk to City Loop Trail staff about the project evolving there. We had some information about the Discovery Walk project. We're on that team, so we can speak to the evolution of the Discovery Walk project and how that's working with the 4th Street project. So it was engaging and important open house meeting. We took the feedback from that meeting, and looked at our designs, and started thinking about next steps and how the design might evolve. After we evolved the design a bit more, we received a couple of letters from the neighborhood associations, and we looked through those, and we responded to those letters, had meetings following up saying, here's how the concerns that have been addressed or raised have been addressed with the design. So we had those meetings in the December timeframe before the holidays. And as we were doing our evaluation process, we were thinking about the DMC District Design Guidelines and how those guidelines could turn into specific evaluation criteria that we could use for the four alternatives that I showed you, plus we evaluated six more that range from slight modifications of those to things that we're getting a little bit farther into, maybe not likely, but we're thinking about if we needed these options, could we accommodate them with a typical section? So the kinds of things we were evaluating from the DMC District Design Guidelines, providing a 16-foot sidewalk zone, all of our concepts have that requirement, meet that requirement. Reducing travel lanes to 11 feet, we have achieved that. We've gone from 18 feet wide lanes.
We have a question.
Yes.
What's the motivation to reduce it to 11 feet? Why that number?
It's to reduce the allocation of right-of-way to cars to give more to pedestrians, bicycles, and other.
So I saw one of the sections, a 6-foot bicycle lane and an 11-foot vehicle lane. Would it make more sense to leave an extra foot to cars and have a 5-foot wide bike lane?
It could. Yeah, we could talk about that when we get to those typical sections. But yes, that's the nature of the discussions that we're having. Every foot matters, and different uses, more of the right-of-way, whether it's parking, bikes, pedestrians, cars. So, yes, that is the name of the game for this discussion.
Thank you.
Correct. So, if you read through the list, there are a number of things that we evaluated and tried to ground much of our evaluation in those specific criteria that have been developed over the last year or more. And then I've got three slides here that just talk briefly about the projects in the vicinity that we've been coordinating with. So Discovery Square Phase 1 on the south side of 4th Street. This project has been in development prior to this happening. The construction schedule of Discovery Square is such that we will leave a piece of sidewalk out that they will construct later on. So there are a number of things happening here that we are coordinating. The Discovery Walk project, so the conversion of 2nd Avenue to a pedestrian priority street. That discussion, that project evolution has been going on. That project is at the schematic design phase today. So we're learning quite a bit about what the intersection of now 2nd Avenue, future Discovery Walk, and 4th Street would look like. And then the City Loop Trail, the City Loop study, the branded bicycle pedestrian system downtown. We looked at how that project relates to 4th Street at the intersection of 3rd and 4th Avenue. There's some pretty interesting bicycle cycle track intersection considerations that have emerged from those discussions, so that project has been accounted for in the work we've done to date. So I'm coming to the end of my slides. Before we put the layout on the table, I wanted to show you the preferred typical sections that we've ended up with. So here's maybe where we can talk a bit more about specific typical section dimensions. So for the preferred option, this is east of 4th and 5th Street. One lane of traffic in this direction, about an 18-foot wide, raised median planted, with bicycle lanes, 6-foot bicycle lanes.
We have a question here.
3-foot buffer between.
While you were talking about the median, if you need to go back to 2 lanes each direction, is that why you have a vegetated median in there at this point, so it could be removed, or?
It is certainly a consideration. The main consideration of all the 10 alternatives, we looked at 10 ways you can slice and dice the right-of-way to serve different uses that may want to have space here. We found that a 58-foot dimension from curb to curb gave us the most flexibility for what could be either striped or built in between. And it's pretty important because when you establish the curb lines, you're establishing storm sewer and utilities and other things, that it's much harder to move the curbs in a future day. It's much easier to do things like if someone said, we need 4 lanes through here, if the development somehow grows in a way that's not forecast, we could pave the median and have 2 traffic lanes in this direction, 4 through lanes. So to address Mayo Clinic's concern, yes, we could pave the median and have 4 through lanes. The other way to think about it is, from the neighborhood's perspective, the neighborhoods want more on-street parking. If we get a lot of development on these adjacent properties where they're currently either parking lots or not highly developed, if we do get developments that come in that do want on-street parking, it's possible that the median could be paved and you could have 2 traffic lanes, 1 in each direction in the median, and these lanes could be turned into parking lanes.
And currently it could be a pedestrian safe spot. If as is.
Correct. And there are other options, so yes, we believe there's a lot of flexibility that's built into this design. That's a 58-foot face-to-face of curb design. So this is what's proposed from generally 4th Avenue to east. For the block to the west of 5th Street, 5th Avenue, that's a more residential block. There's a need for on-street parking adjacent to those existing apartments. So the same 58-foot face-to-face of curb dimension is carved up with traffic lanes in the center. So nobody's median, bike lanes, instead of just a buffer between the cars that are driving and the bikes, there's also a 3-foot buffer, just a paved strip on the pavement between.
We have a question here,
yes,
as well.
So at the danger of doing council math through the meeting, we've got essentially 11-foot wide bike lanes and 11-foot wide traffic lanes. Is that right? Am I cutting that up right?
That is 11, correct.
So 11-foot wide bike lanes and 11-foot wide vehicle lanes.
That's correct.
How wide is a semi?
Semi, with, you typically think that a semi has to have an 11-foot length, about 10'8" to the outside of the mirrors.
Seems a pretty tough fit, an 11-foot lane.
Correct. And that's been a statewide discussion for the last 3 or 4 years. MnDOT had said 12-foot lanes was the minimum lane dimension until maybe 3 years ago, went to 11. And now the standards have been reduced even to potentially 10 feet in certain low truck and low heavy vehicle situations.
I assume the vehicle or trucks are still going to deliver downtown.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, we've done other projects that have gone through this very same discussion. Most recent example I can think of, downtown Anoka, Minnesota, right through their central business district, we reduced traffic lanes from 12 or 13 feet to 11 feet and put bump outs at intersections and went through very rigorous truck site visits where we put out cones and painted lines on pavement and had trucks run through all those areas. And, it worked well enough to convince them the design was right. It's been in place now for 8 years and have had no issues with trucks through downtown New York with 11 foot lanes.
All right, thank you.
Yep. So when I say this typical section ends at about 5th Avenue, between 5th Avenue and 4th Avenue, we have a, let's see this, maybe you should take the layout on the table at this point. There's a transition where you have to go from introducing this 18-foot wide raised median to no raised median, so a block from 5th Avenue to 6th Avenue. So
got any closer window than February, April, or
for design?
As yeah, for the final design.
I mean, I could say that final design is going to start as soon as approval is given on the 5th of February, and then we'll probably have 60% design plans done in the midpoint of this period, and then 90-95% plans done right before April, and then you know, those kinds of intermediate milestones. I think the main milestone is the open house. So I'm assuming we're going to have an open house in late April. That's not on this slide.
And you're going to continue stakeholder meetings in between that time?
Yeah, I mean, for the very reason you're mentioning, there's still a lot of interest and concern in both directions, both that we're not addressing the pedestrian and bike neighborhood issue satisfactorily, and we're not addressing the Mayo Clinic's concern about four lanes satisfactorily.
Yeah, and I think in reality too, this is a where the neighbors and the business district are kind of meshing and are meshing, and we need to make sure that we take care of a lot of pedestrians, a lot of people who work downtown, park their cars in these neighborhoods, and we need to make sure that they're able to safely get to work as well as to have places to park their cars, because this is an area that's been inundated for years with the business traffic. And so we need to make sure that we get that addressed.
Mr. Wojcik?
Well, I just want to clarify, too, that the ongoing discussions are very important, but once we set the geometry, 95% of everything's off the table. That's the back and forth right now. So I don't want to mislead anybody on that portion of it. The other part that I keep hearing Mayo Clinic wants four lanes, Mayo Clinic wants four lanes. Mayo Clinic's a pretty big entity. Who exactly is driving that decision? And you know, because they're not coming to the public meetings with everyone else and being part of those discussions. How do we get them engaged with the other stakeholders? Because they really should be at the table with everyone else too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean it's clearly part of a individual stakeholder meeting to understand those issues. There are open houses. That's a forum to do that. If we feel that there may be some other decision making that we need to take that gets those groups together,
who's driving this at Mayo Clinic?
names?
Yes.
So we've met with Tim Siegfried
mm-hmm.
and Michelle McDermott, and those are the two facilities folks that are the
How do we get these people into a meeting with the community members that they live in? Because that's not happening, even with the open houses right now. We're having these community meetings where there's broad consensus, and then there's Mayo Clinic on the other side of things.
Right, and I think there's a level of, I'd say, traffic data that needs to be factored into this. So
yep.
One of the biggest decisions we had early on in the project was if you took just the traffic data from MnDOT that exists today and what's on 4th Street today, if you took the typical traffic forecasting techniques that could take into consideration all the complexity that's happening in Rochester, we would have to have 4 lanes
yeah.
on 4th Street just because that's the best information.
Or you could take the trend and it would go the other way.
The DMC transit studies that are happening.
Right.
Looked at really the details of how traffic.
And I completely understand the flexibility of why we want at least that option to go to 4 lanes in the future. I'm sold on that part. No issues there or anything like that. But I would point out that in our studies, 4th Street is a less of a road classification than 6th Street is.
Okay.
6th Street is a 3-lane design with bike lane and parking. This is a lower level of traffic impact than that street. And I remember fighting that battle and losing on a 4-3 vote on 6th Street. I think Mr. Bilderback probably remembers that as well. And so that's the baseline that I'm going from.
I don't know how much time we have to talk about some of those things, but we can certainly talk about the street typology information that's coming out of the DMC and the other transit studies that talk about the character of 4th Street in comparison to 6th Street and how the characters of both of those streets is anticipated to change generally where you cross 3rd and 4th Avenue. Everything east of 3rd and 4th Avenue is much more central business district. West of that is much more residential. So this red system at the time was called Main Street. That may have changed recently, but it's
mm-hmm.
Main Street design. This light blue is a multimodal street. The darker blue here is indicated as a transit street. So there's a long-term picture of how the streets function that may not match exactly where they are today, but yeah, we're taking into consideration this. These are the kinds of things we've discussed with the neighborhood associations.
Would it be fair to say that 4th Street will never come close to the impact that 6th Street has in terms of moving traffic because there's no through?
I don't know if I can say that at the moment. There's a lot to change. When 6th Street, the bridge for 6th going over the river comes in, certainly 6th Street is going to change
yeah.
in a different way. It'll be much more, it might pull traffic off and forth. And a lot of those traffic considerations are built into the DMC transit traffic model, which is what gave us the traffic forecasting that said we don't have today in our 2040 crystal ball, a 4-lane need on 4th Street. So we have been able to say Mayo Clinic, given all the development, it's counterintuitive, but it's true based on the forecasting. We do not need 4 lanes on 4th Street.
So finishes that up because I know we got to move on. My concern is induced demand, which I'm sure you understand what induced demand is, and that's a real concern in how we design the road here, including excessive speeding as a result of the design. And the other part is when we're having these discussions and we're trying to bring folks together, Mayo Clinic can't be in a silo. They have got to get out there and interact with the community. We should not be promoting that kind of behavior where they have a separate set of meetings and are not interacting with the other stakeholders.
I hear your concern, and it hasn't been quite that way. We've had individual stakeholder meetings with each neighborhood association by themselves. I've had a lunch or two with Patrick to talk about what's happening. We've had meetings with Mayo Clinic, and we've had open houses, and we have meetings like this where Mayo Clinic was invited. We encouraged Mayo Clinic to be here. I think they said they were going to be,
but they're not.
Right.
Just like with the community open houses.
And I can't say I know all that history, but yeah, the goal is to make sure we get those issues resolved in the way people
And that's my goal, too, and I think that's Mr. Bilderback's goal.
Mr. Bilderback.
I'm just, and Richard, maybe you can help me here. I'm looking at the timeline, and I want to make sure that we have ample time to make sure that the stakeholders all have an opportunity to have some dialogue to figure out where we're at in this. Do we have that time, or is this going to be one of these things where we need to pass this and then we're kind of SOL as far as any kind of community st- stakeholders getting together to have a discussion on how this all rolls out?
Well, we have between now and February 5th to have those conversations. I don't think there's going to be any new conversation that will take place. I think the neighborhood activists have been pretty consistent in their message. We've heard the message. We've evaluated their request. We've made a decision on what we can support and what we can't. We've communicated that back as late as yesterday, granted. And to follow up and now have a discussion about that is something we can do between now and the 5th. But, you know, I disagree with Michael's comment that, you know, once we set the 95 feet, everything's decided. I think the point we're making today is once you set the 58 feet, nothing is set in stone. You have all sorts of flexibility. Dan showed you four options.
Right.
They all work within 58 feet.
As well as Mr. Hickey has also brought up some other options as
well. So, I mean, we have many options as a community. This street will be built to last 50 years, if not longer. There will be many changes that occur potentially in the layout of the street. The question is, how do we build it initially? There's no demand for on-street parking today. There really isn't, other than in front of the apartments. The people that are parking there are basically plugging meters for 10 hours a day. That's not parking demand. That's taking advantage of the fact that there's a parking meter there and plugging the meter instead of, you know, utilizing some other facility.
There again, that's something that we can do with our traffic enforcement as far as making a two-hour limit and things of that nature. But there are businesses, and I go frequent downtown, and I don't have the luxury of having a parking space like I used to. I gave that up when I retired. But the fact is, it is difficult to find parking in that area, and it may be for the reason you say, but then that really comes back to an enforcement issue. My whole thing is I want to make sure that we have an opportunity with the stakeholders and still have some discussion. Mr. Hickey brought up some questions about what he'd like to see or what options could be done. And I think that's where we're at. The 58-foot, I don't believe anybody has an issue with that. The issue is, what do we do with that 58 feet? How do we make it so it's pedestrian-friendly or multimodal, workable? And how do we make sure that everybody that wants to have these conversations can have these conversations before we come with a final plan?
Okay. So, again, we can stand here and have a lot of discussion about this. There's going to be over 1,000 parking stalls available for this particular corridor within. There's currently about 400 and some, almost 500 available today in the 3rd Street ramp, less than half a block away, and Mail's building another 800 on this very corridor, beginning probably next year, possibly even later this year. So there's all sorts of opportunities for parking. And to facilitate on-street parking for people who want to park there all day long, and that's what's happening. There is no demand right now for on-street parking of a short-term nature there. If that demand is created, there are two options. One is to make a change in the section. The other is to require the developer to provide additional space, curb space, if you will, additional right-of-way for their parking bay, if you will, to serve that business. There's no request from Discovery Square for on-street parking. You look at their graphic there. They were not showing the parking in the 4th Street Boulevard. They were basically showing that as landscape consistent with the DMC plan of a 16-foot pedestrian space. So we're at the point now where, again, what we're asking you to approve is a geometric layout plan, and that's where it establishes that 16-foot pedestrian zone on each side of the street and then a 58-foot face-to-face curb section. And what we do within that, then we would have more time to discuss that after February 5th. But the longer we delay, the later this project gets started. And again, it needs to occur in 2018.
Mr. Hickey?
What are the time limits on the meters right now? Longer?
It varies in there. I can't cite off the top of my head. I think there's probably some 2 hours and 3 hours in there, and then there's some 10 hours in that area, too.
So it seems like the point that Mr. Bildar made, it sounds like it's more of an enforcement issue than... I mean, it's 2 hour parking.
It's almost an impossible enforcement issue when you have people coming out and plugging the meters. Okay. So it may be a 2 hour meter, and they just
how do we do it, Rob? I thought the old days had chalk tires.
Yeah. Some of the new technology that we're getting now with the handheld devices and stuff, law enforcement can do that.
But there's very limited, little parking there today as far as spaces. And so it's not like we're eliminating, you know, 50 parking spaces. We're not doing that. Because there's no parking right now between 5th and 3rd at all on the street. So there's just the one block between 2nd and 1st and then between 5th and 6th.
Mr. Wojcik.
So I absolutely love Richard to death, but I do disagree with him on some of this stuff. And I do want to make a couple points that are inconsistent between this and our past practices. The idea that now we are going to prove a need for on-street parking, I love that. Let's do it on every road, because every road we build from now on is going to be 20 feet wide, because nobody's going to prove a need for on-street parking anywhere. We're going to save a ton of money that way. This is something new that I've never seen introduced before. I do want to bring it back to the DMC plan, though, but one thing that everybody, there's a wide consensus on in the community, is that we want active, vibrant streets at the ground level throughout our downtown. And it's difficult for businesses if they don't have some spots where people can go in and out for quick trips and some buffering from the traffic itself, to actually be successful in that way. The parking is purely an enforcement issue, and the great thing about meters is we set the rates, we set the times, and we set the level of enforcement, the technology that are there. That's something that can be done. But yeah, maybe I'm just dealing with this in the long term, making it available as a possibility. What I did want to point out is looking at the what's there today relative to this geometry and also comparing that to the neighborhood suggestion. This actually brings it down about 33 parking spots that are in the corridor right now, whereas the neighborhood actually increases it by about 33 parking spots. That's 66 parking spots. Those parking spots having economic value to the city of Rochester. We are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the DMC plan to create parking spaces. I think the most recent project was something, I don't know, $37,500 was one of the recent projects, but somewhere between 25 and 37,000 per parking spot. The economic value of those parking spots, the difference between what the neighbors are asking for and what the city is asking for, is on the order of $2.5 million. That's parking spots that we're paying for elsewhere that could potentially be here. And lastly, when we talk about nobody's asking for parking today except for Newbridge, that makes my skin crawl from the standpoint that there are some of us who voted that we would be a compassionate city. That is the caregiver parking for the people in Newbridge. The people who are coming in, that is a affordable, accessible project where there are a lot of people with special needs there, and that is where their caregivers are parking today, and that's just something that Newbridge has been saying for a very long time that's important to them. So if compassion is truly a driver, we've really got to bring them into the process as well.
So, as I understand the decision at this point, it's largely to agree on whether we agree on the 16-foot pedestrian buffers on either side and a 58-foot corridor in the middle, and then the details come after that. I suspect, realistically, that we're probably going to get to a point where we have two or three options, and we're going to choose one, and not everyone will be happy. I'll just say, as I look through the options that are presented today, I'm going to have real reservations about limiting vehicular traffic to one lane in either direction. Now, you've shown other options, and I'll be glad to entertain those. But I say this as someone who drives that road almost every day, twice a day, and I see stacking concerns as people are trying to make left turns into parking lots and so forth. So I'm just going to have some real reservations if you want to try to limit it to one lane in either direction, but I'm open to the discussion. Mrs. Johnson.
I have a quick question on the 3-foot bike buffer. Is that just concrete, or is that an actual physical barrier buffer?
It would be painted only.
Painted only? Okay. Because one of the concerns I have, I live off of 41st Street, and we have a very... we have bike lanes there, but when people make left-hand turns, there are cars passing in the bike lanes, and that would be a concern of mine in that area. Yes. If there's a left-hand turn happening, people are going to pass in those areas.
So the thing we have talked about is there are mainly ways to delineate bike lanes to help avoid that type of encroachment by cars into a bike lane. So the buffer is more about kind of when you're out, when cars are parallel to bikes, having some separation from the moving traffic.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at intersections, there's another practice to paint the bike lanes green so that as more drivers around Rochester see that technology, that technique being used, it indicates where cars and bikes potentially are in conflict, and if cars are paying attention, they'll move out of those green painted areas. So you'll see on this layout, you'll see a lot of green painting.
Okay.
Bring it up on the screen for others who can't see the layout. There are green painted areas, typically where you see right-hand turns off of a side road onto 4th Street, where cars might tend to drift into a bike lane.
Okay.
That initial area is...
So in regard to your left-hand turn comment, that's why there are three intersections where left-hand turn bays are created.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And where we don't need that left-hand turn bay, then we basically are proposing that rest of that space be landscape. So
okay.
you just can't add a lane and then drop it right away. You have to have transitions.
Mm-hmm.
So in those transition zones, that's where the landscaping occurs.
Okay.
So we have left turn lane both east and west at 3rd and 4th Avenues, and also another left-hand turn lane for eastbound at 1st Avenue.
I'm looking specifically between 5th and 6th Avenue.
So this is
a very low left-hand
is it? Okay.
volumes there.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the housing there, so...
So this is 5th Avenue.
Think surface parking lot.
What's that?
Think surface parking lot.
So the particular use of green we're using is not about left turns. It's mainly about crossing and right-turning traffic. So if you're a car coming out on 5th Avenue, you'll see pedal crosswalk. This is your typical white painted crosswalk for pedestrians. Then you'll see a green painted strip here that will typically have a bike symbol in it, indicating if you're driving across that, that's where you should expect to see bikes. If you're making a right-hand turn, given the curb is here, you may tend to drift into the area closest to the curb, just making a right-hand turn, but the green that we paint here is intended to alert motorists that that's not a lane, that's a bike lane. There's a bike lane symbol there, and then cars will move out. And over time, people get used to that, but it's a industry standard in how to mark bike lanes.
Okay, thank you.
This is a concept that has been passed by the Pet and Bike Committee recently.
Okay.
And so this layout has been presented to them, and they also have chimed in that this is an acceptable layout.
Okay.
Mr. Bildebeck?
I do want to say, as much as I've been complaining or trying to bring the issues of the neighborhood forward, they have said that working with Kimberly Horn has been a very good experience. They've enjoyed working with you guys and wish to continue, but I do need to make sure that I bring the concerns of the neighborhoods forward.
Yeah, I think the process has been good in the sense we've had great conversations. We have differences of opinion. We're trying to accommodate what we hear and find commonality, and there's certainly places where we're still apart, and the question is, will we ever be able to resolve that, or is there are there decisions that just have to get made?
So, Mr. President,
yes.
If you would indulge us for another few minutes, I will share with you what is the probably sticking point remaining.
Okay.
And, you know, the neighborhoods will say there are many, but I think there really is only one.
Okay.
And when we boil it right down to it, and Dan, if you just want to get to the 500 block there, it's the matter of where this bike lane resides within the cross section. Does it reside as shown here on the drawing? So in other words, it's adjacent to the travel, buffered from the travel lane and buffered from the parking lane. Or is it adjacent to the curb and buffered from, so the cars would park between the two stripes, kind of look at it that way. So the alternative is the cars, instead of parking adjacent to the curb like everybody's used to, backing up, feeling that right rear tire hit the curb, pulling ahead a little bit, and then backing up and parking, there's going to be nothing there. They're going to park out in the street. And so the cars would park, in essence, the bike lane, and the bike lane would shift to where the cars are parked.
They did that in Minneapolis. Do we have any kind of...
Yes, and they basically are saying that it's a maintenance nightmare for them in the winter. They can't get there with a snowplow because the cars are parked. Right. And the other thing that happens at the intersection is that bike lane goes through the bulb out
And now, again, I don't have any snow removal equipment that I can get to that with. Even if the parked cars are gone, I can get to where this parking bay is shown. But once that bike lane is extended through the bulb out, it's basically a sidewalk. And it's even though it's 6 feet wide, I can't get there with a snowplow. So okay. Now that crosswalk has gotten longer, that bike lane has gotten in an area, and we discussed this with the bike and ped committee, if that lane isn't available for use by a bicyclist after a snow, what good is it for the biker? In other words, the biker then has to resort to go back out the street. With the bike lane that's shown here, I can plow that with a snowplow. I can plow that and clear it at the same time I'm clearing the street. So the bike lane is open at the same time that the street is open from a snow removal perspective.
During the summers, is there any statistics that we know about the safety? Is it a safer route for the bicyclists? Is there more injuries because pedestrian or passengers aren't looking and opening their doors? Do we have any kind of?
I think there's the research is all over the place on it. There are plate studies that show that it's safer here. There are others that raise the issues like you do. A driver is more accustomed to being cautious when opening the door because they're used to traffic going by, but somebody on the passenger side is not typically aware of that. The other thing that we've heard about is the fact that people, again, parallel parking, kind of in this middle of the street. It's not really the middle, but you're kind of in the middle. You don't have a curb. And again, think of how you parallel park. What do you do when you parallel park? You back up and you wait for that right rear tire to hit the curb, and then you pull forward, right?
Not me.
Okay. No. Well, I know you're perfect. All the time,
just so. About.
But that's the thing here, and what the research is saying is the incident of one car that's parked across the line because they didn't get parked properly. I mean, just walk downtown and see how many cars parked 2 feet from the curb now. There's a lot. A foot from the curb. So if they're parked over the line, then they're basically encroaching into the bike lane. So it's been tried. It works best in warm weather climates. And, you know, people will adjust over time. I understand that. But is this the best place to introduce that concept for in essence, one or two blocks?
Is this an opportunity to trial some different things, like putting the orange pylons in to separate the bike? I mean, if you do the inside, is this an area to try to do a protected bike lane? We've talked about it, and we talked about the need of going and having
well,
a
these are
bike
protected.
Lane.
That's what the
right, but I'm just saying, even with the cars backing in, would this be an opportunity if you put the orange pylons in there to try to help?
My intent is the first year it's constructed, yeah. That we do that just basically to help as a tool, a guide, but the snowplow will rip all of those out every winter.
Right away.
So,
yes.
Right. And so again, either you leave them and you pile snow up like we've got the orange barrels in front of the Civic Center right now, because we've got a lane closed there, we got the orange construction barrels, we've got snowplow piled up there because we can't plow around it. So we could try it, but what I'm basically saying is I can't provide the level, I can't meet the expectations of those who want it in that location, so I'm reluctant to do that. And the reason I can't meet the expectation is I can't remove the snow in that area. And Minneapolis has found the same thing.
Mr. Hickey?
So just so this section we're looking at, this is the section where we have 11-foot wide bike lanes and 11-foot wide vehicle lanes?
Correct.
So, I mean, so certainly in winter, I mean, the bike lanes are empty. And for whatever reason, in Rochester, the bike lanes are empty most of the time, all the time. They dedicate 50% of our roadway to bikes. I mean, we'd be better off having dedicated snowmobile lanes. It would make as much sense. I mean, this layout makes no sense at all. It's not a good use of the right-of-way. So that's where I'm leaning right now.
To build a back. I have plenty of bicycles year-round going through my neighborhood, and so I don't think they're totally empty. Maybe you don't see them, but I do. I'm downtown a lot, and my neighborhood has bicyclists who are bicycling all the time. I think the whole thing is what we have to do is figure out how to be multimodal in this city and try to make it work. I'm not saying this is the right way. I understand what Richard's saying, but I do believe we need to work to try to figure out a way to make this operational for everybody in this city.
Okay.
element of additional information here when we talk about allocating right-of-way to different uses. Our initial concept, if you remember the first few slides, had just 6-foot bike lanes with no buffers. And it was as there were discussions with folks that were interested in having protected cycle tracks, so it's a cycle track with maybe a curb between the traffic lanes and the bike lanes. There were those kinds of discussions where we talked about the operational concerns about snow plowing and other things where we said, well, maybe instead of doing a protected cycle track, we do buffered bike lanes. So the idea of a buffer on the street side is adding space. Maybe the technical detail here is this 3-foot space on the parking side is added to a 7-foot parking lane. So essentially, you still have a 10-foot parking lane. So if we didn't have this buffer on the parking side, we would just have a 10-foot parking lane. So the buffer on the parking side just helps drivers that are parking get a little farther away from the bike lane, so that door swing issue is not a big deal. So this is really not taking more space than we would otherwise allocate. It's this buffer here that's truly a choice to allocate more space to bikes.
And Councilman Hickey, I think, again, that's that flexibility. And, you know, so that 11-foot lane, that 11-foot bike lane can become an 11-foot traffic lane.
So why not get it right the first time? Then in the future, if we have this surge bikes, we can restart it with a canopy.
There's no need for 4 lanes in this section of the roadway today.
Yeah, that's right here. That's not what I see.
Right. 3 lanes is more than sufficient. That's pretty much the way it operates today because the traffic in the inside lanes, I think Randy will attest to this, is always left-turning traffic. So really it's functioning as a left-turn lane on the inside lanes, and there's one lane. Mm-hmm. Basically in each direction today.
And now we're going to pave over the second lane, except for when it's a dedicated turn lane.
Yeah, so I mean, we're in essence creating the same situation, but with a lesser pavement section.
Not buying it, but okay. Keep going.
Mr. Wojcik.
Well, I would say that it's interesting because for Public Works, we're pulling them in opposite directions, and I'm just waiting for somebody to... some limb to snap or something, but I would say that you made some persuasive arguments about what Minneapolis is doing, and there are some maintenance issues with how you do a protected bikeway, but a couple of things that I think were not entirely factual is, first of all, Minneapolis has made the decision to go almost extensively with protected bikeways because they are so much safer, and second of all, some of the world leaders in bikeway design and create a hierarchy of bikeway safety, and certainly buffered and physically protected bike lanes are always going to be at a better point on that hierarchy of design than the others. And you know, we can argue night and day. I don't have any belief that I'm ever going to convince Mr. Hickey that we should have bike lanes. I'm not going to necessarily take that battle.
As long as there's room for
it.
As long as we're not choking down traffic intentionally.
But go look on a when you leave here today, go look under the 3rd Street ramp. You'll see some a smattering of bicycles in there, and you go there that same area. There's going to be 5 or 6 ramps in the summer. Literally hundreds, if not more than 1,000 bikes parked there on a summer day. So they're coming from somewhere. It would be easier to have these discussions too if the planning that leads into all this was all approved prior to this discussion, but. That does make it more complicated.
All right. Other comments or questions for this afternoon on this topic?
So
Ms. Johnson?
We're not making any decisions today. I just want to be clear on this.
Correct.
Okay.
This is coming back February 5th.
February 5th.
Okay. Coming back to committee?
The approval of
council.
The GM
council.
Oh, to council. Okay.
The council is a
No, it's to set the hearing, approve the geometric layout and
the feasibility
accept the
report.
Feasibility.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Go run through that again. I missed it.
To accept the feasibility report, approve the geometric layout, and set a project hearing.
Project hearing.
That's February 5th.
February 5th.
Yep.
Quick question. I know we have all kinds of traffic data. Have we ever made an attempt to get the bicycle data on this corridor? Do we know any idea of how many bicycles?
When we did our traffic counts, we set up video cameras, so it's the newest technology for
right.
Traffic counting. It allows for many different vehicle types to be automatically rather than the person sitting there looking
sure.
at just cars and missing all the bikes and peds. So we did do a count that included peds, bikes, trucks, different vehicle types. So we have that information. So for the most part, we've been using the ped counts because there's a heavy north-south component to employees coming to the Mayo Clinic parking lot. So we're looking at how many people are crossing streets. I think we've got the bike numbers that I could get.
Does that talk about when they do the count, are you getting them with the intersection and mid-block or just
intersections?
Just the intersections.
Well, it's always hard to reference those kind of numbers in a changing environment. Just the addition of the food co-op property and the 501 First property substantially increased the number of cyclists, and that was just one block. And that's the way this area is going. And not a lot of people bicycle in places that are incredibly unpleasant to bicycle in. And I've biked 4th Street enough to know it's pretty unpleasant.
Well, and with density, we're going to see more of the pedestrian, more of the bicyclist, and things of that nature. If that's truly what we're working to do, is a higher density in the downtown, those kind of things will be the norm for many more people.
The discussion will continue, no doubt.
Dun, dun, dun.
You know, I think we're all struggling with trying to make the best use of limited right-of-way. And so that's where I'm going to have questions, again, especially if we have single lanes of traffic. I don't know what the right mix is of buffers and lanes and vehicular lanes, but we'll see where the discussion goes. Anything else then?
Are we going to follow up with some meeting? Are we going to organize some meetings then to get these parties together?
Are you going to be still meeting with the stakeholders? I guess that we know we have a February 5th deadline.
That's a good point. If you want, if you're looking for input from other stakeholders, apparently you're hearing from a lot of people that have comments. Are they outside of the neighborhood association?
Yeah, there are some businesses that I've heard from that are also interested in participating. Again, when you look at the neighborhood association, those who choose to go and look at the messaging that they're sending out, that they're having meetings. And so businesses are also contacting me about some of the issues here. So let's try to reach out to everybody along that route. I'm not sure if you're sending out cards or how you're sending notification out, but
so everyone in the corridor at a distance from the corridor receives invitations from the city to the open houses.
Okay.
Plus the neighborhood associations.
All right, perfect. I think, like I said, this is one that in my 10 years in the council, I'm hearing more than I believe I've heard in so many things. And we've had some pretty hot things come up in the past when we start talking about light fees and things of this nature.
I'll just say that this is probably the most public outreach sessions we've had on any project.
Okay. Well, please, in any that you do in the future, make sure that I'm contacted as well. And I'll try to work it in.
Okay. Anything else for this afternoon? Remember, we're supposed to be in the council chambers by 6:30 p.m. for your annual portrait. All right.
So, are we going to do it if Mr. Rust is not going to be here? We're still going to take a picture.
Is Mr. Rust going to be here?
We're still going to take it? Or?
He said that's okay. He's got it. You know what? I'm going to draw a picture of him.